Session number 19013, Reel 2.
Bob Rose, Reel 2. Before, you know, we talk about D-Day, presumably your training extended once you'd done your spot landings and done circuits and bumps. You did cross countries, did you?
Did cross countries and, of course, a little bit of formation flying. No more than three in a formation. It was just to get you used to having someone on either side of you, sort of hemming you in and this sort of thing. But not a great deal. And then, of course, we started to do, I suppose, they go down in the book as mass landings on Netherhaven and places like this, where we're putting 90 gliders down and this sort of thing. In the daytime and by moonlight and so on and so forth. So there's quite a lot of activity there. We did quite a bit of flying, actually. But the problem was you're not building up a lot of hours. You know, you're looking at RAF pilot's logbook, and of course he's got thousands of hours. But of course we got very little actual airtime because we were concentrating on takeoffs and landings. That was how it was sort of structured.
How were mass landings organised? Because you all had to land at once.
Yes. No. You must approach into wind, of course.
Yeah.
So you would say, first of all, you would send your advance paras in, who would have small lights, and they would light a tee up on the landing ground. So that you were always landing into the tee, a row there and a row here. And of course, you would approach normally in two sticks, side by side, you see, staggered. And of course, number one would go in, number two would go in. And then, of course, you would, as you were further back, then you tended then to move further over to starboard and so on. And go in, and then after a while, by pulling off earlier, then of course you could land behind one another, you see. And this was the idea of getting the compact.
So the idea was to end up in neat rows.
Neat rows or in a box, if you like. In a box would be better, a compact box. I always remember on one. At Netherhaven, which was supposed to be a moonlight landing. Moonlight landings were quite good normally. If you had a nice summer's evening with, you know, get up to about 11 o'clock at night and a nice moon, you had your fairly clearly defined lights on the ground and you could go in. But of course, when we're coming up onto the landing zone, we had about 7/10 cloud coming in and blotting the moon out, and of course we had landing lights on the aircraft. They were fed from batteries, which gave you, I don't know, no more than about 10 minutes of full light, you see, which would light the ground in front of you. Unfortunately, the chaps who had gone in first had put the lights on and left them on. So we had this, as we followed in, you had these streams of light all over the place. So you've the light. But I think we lost about 10 aircraft on that one landing out of something like 90, which was not considered to be a viable sort of.
Was that crashing into aircraft on the ground?
Yeah, hitting one another on the ground, and demolishing tailplanes and wings.
Were there many casualties then?
Broken arms, broken legs, that sort of thing. There was as far as I could remember, there was nobody killed at all. But you know, lots of stories to tell afterwards, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, that period then, leading up to D-Day, was very compressed. There was flying virtually every day, and if we were not flying, we were loading and unloading and this sort of thing. And it's a full sort of programme. And of course we were doing link trainer work in between. Used to have a chit, we had to go around and we had to report to the gym for so many hours a week, and PTI would sign your chit to say that you'd done so many hours in the gym, so many hours on the link trainer and all this sort of thing. So it was not all flying, obviously there was quite a bit. And then of course little bits of route marches in between, so they kept us busy, kept us fairly fit.
Did you get a bit of time off at Keyhole?
Oh yes, yeah, we used to do, except for night flying, which sort of fell maybe week and week about, we would normally be finished by up past 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And then of course it was Trowbridge, Bradford-on-Avon, Bath, all the way around for, you know, relaxation, whatever you call it. But, it was quite interesting. And there's lots of civilians on the drone, and of course, in the hangars. And another interesting thing, which I remember on the 40th anniversary, I mentioned it in a newspaper article, about Keevil being an interesting and exhilarating place to be and all the rest of it. And we had a lot of Navy personnel there. And the idea of the Navy being stationed in the centre of Wiltshire, of course they were all aircrew fitters from the Fleet Air Arm, actually, who had been seconded to us because of the massive aircraft that we had, you see. The RAF personnel couldn't cope with it, you see, so they moved in, these RAF people. I don't know where they came from, probably down Yeovilton or somewhere like that. But we had quite a number on there, and they were all involved in aero engine fitters and riggers and this sort of thing. So it's quite interesting.
Going back to these practice mass landings,
yeah.
I would have thought that when you all got down, it took quite a bit of time to sort out all the gliders to take them back to base, wasn't it?
Yeah, they were usually, they would probably be flyable, you see. So they would be collected the following day and you'd take off with them and, take them back to base. If they were damaged, of course, then they had to be put on the transporters and taken back to the factory and all that sort of stuff. That was an interesting little interlude we had. It was building up to D-Day. We used to go down to the factory at Christchurch, which is an aerodrome, airspeeds base, actually. And it was more or less a PR job. We would go down in crews, and we'd fly down probably in a Dakota. I'm desperately trying to think of the other aircraft we used to use. Andy Page. No, the smaller one, the twin engine. Oh dear. That dreadful. I hope you read it that bit out. I should know that.
Well, it's a tug, was it?
Tug.
Albemarle?
No. We did use Albemarles at one stage.
Dear,
it won't come. May come later.
Andy Page, was it?
No,
Wellington?
No. They did try Wellingtons, and the geodetic construction of them used to stretch the fuselage.
Really?
It'll
come.
Twin engines. Dreadful. Used to sit in the tail gun, tail unit there. Tail gun at Whitley, Andy, with the Whitley. And of course, we'd go down to the factory and we had to do the PR job where we went round the factory and talked to all the workers in the factory, you know, and these are the boys who are going to fly your airplanes and all the rest of it. And you were sort of making dates with these girls and all the rest of it, but you never got back there again. And then we'd go in the MD's office, and I have a small whiskey. He used to say, all small whiskies for flyers, he said, don't want full ones. And then, of course, we would collect the brand new aircraft. That was interesting, because you just have to put the horse with its tail right in the hedge on one side of the aerodrome. You would put the rope on, tighten the rope, and then climb aboard, and then they would stop the traffic on the main road whilst you took off. And you used to go over that main road with no more than about 10 feet to spare sometimes. And that was quite interesting. And then, of course, we would shunt those aircraft about to various drums all over the south, you see, and just go in and land them. One of our favourite ploys was if we felt that they'd not had gliders there before. We usually approach at about 2,000 feet, and with no communication in those days between the tug and the glider, there was later two wires sort of weaved into the rope, but the rope used to stretch and the wires used to break. So usually it was signals by moving your wings left to right and pulling your nose up or whatever, you see. But we'd go in onto these strange-to-us aerodromes and cast off at 2,000 feet. And we'd get a green very light from the signals area. And we'd come round, and of course, as we approached, put full flap on. And of course, put the nose down as far as it would go. I don't know whether you saw that picture on the end the other night of this bloke who crashed at
Trefford.
Mm. You know how steep he was. Mm. That's what we were doing. We were coming in steep like that, on full flap, you see. And then at the last moment, just easing it out and putting it down on the deck. And of course, we had a saying amongst ourselves, if you don't get the blood wagon, the ambulance and the fire engine moving, you haven't made a good job of it. So that was one of the sort of lighter moments of flying the horse gliders, to take them in where they'd not been seen before, you know, and give them the thrill of the approach, which was enjoyable from our point of view as well. Used to get all sorts of stories where I'd say, well, my goodness, you landed that in a like confined space. So, well, were you going to take it now? Or going to take it over to that dispersal? Well, if you'd marked that out, we could have put it there for you as well, you know. And of course, you had all this bravado, which went with the job. It was a good regiment to be in.
You had a squadron number, did you, for...
Yeah, we were D squadron, and five flight, and I never really knew. I knew at on at yes, I knew on D Day that we had an artillery unit, because we had a jeep and a trailer with 6 pounder ammunition in it. Now the trouble was that hardly met the people you were going to carry until the last moment, you see, and then you go through the loading procedure and the unloading procedure and so on with them, and that's as much as you really knew them. You never went out socially with them. There was never time. They used to turn up the day before, sort of thing, and I think on D-Day...
They were paras, were they?
Oh, no, they were Air Landing Brigade.
Oh.
And
how did you load your hawser? I mean,
we always had the Mark One, of course. They brought the Mark Two out afterwards. The hawser is built on an 8-foot tube, if you like. Now, the cockpit is stuck on the front with two pilots side by side and the centre console. And you must have seen photographs of it. Mm. Now, behind the port pilot on that side, there was a fairly large door. which came down, and it was like a segment, if you like, of that side of the aircraft. And that went down onto a ramp, you see. And then, of course, the Jeep would run up the ramp and hopefully stop at the top. That was the difficult bit. You had to have a lot of way on to get up the ramp. Why they didn't make the ramps three or four times longer, I never know. But anyway, you get up the top, and then, of course, you had to slam the brakes on, so, or you go straight through the other side, this sort of thing. And then you would manoeuvre that round, and it would be resting on mild steel channels running right the way through the length of the glider. And it would sit on these, and then it would be shackled down. So that would be taken through with its radiator pointing out, touching the tail virtually. And of course, if you were carrying a trailer or a 6-pounder gun, that would then go and be connected up and then shackled down, you see. I'll tell you an interesting story about the unloading at Arnhem when we get round to it. But this was all practice. Getting it in, balancing it. Of course, they had all sorts of gadgets for balancing it. But the glider pilot regiment decided that there was a much easier way. And that was for the first pilot to jump up and grab the tail. And then if he could pull it down so that it brought the nose wheel off the ground, then the load was right. There was very little mathematics about it. It was as near as damn it correct. So long as you could pull the nose wheel up, then yeah. If you couldn't, then you moved it about a bit until you could. Once you got achieved that situation, then she was balanced. D-Day, of course, we went off in the second lift. We were support weapons, you see, anti-tank guns, trailers of ammunition, this sort of thing. The first lift was usually troops. And as you know, the Hawser would carry 30 fully equipped soldiers, four or five bikes, this sort of thing, and maybe a hand cart. And then, of course, when we went in, we were carrying the support weapons, the 6-pounder gun in the main. And we took off in the evening. D-Day, the first landings, if I remember right, were just after midnight. Now, Bill Higgs was involved with those. Just after midnight, there'd been the coup de main operation on the bridge, where these three gliders landed very close-knit together.
What became known as Pegasus 3.
That's right, yeah. That's it. And, of course, we always lacked a PR man in later years, because if you ask the average Mr. Public for years and years and years, and even now, who captured Pegasus Bridge, they will always tell you it was the Paras. And that's why we lacked a PR man. We never really had a PR man. But it was a fact, of course, that John Howard's men, with Johnny Walwork as the leading first pilot, he put his nose virtually through the wire entanglement at the end of the bridge, and they were in, and they lost one chap as far as I know, and he jumped out of the third glider on that side and landed in a duck pond, and he was so heavily laden he drowned, and nobody knew they lost him, you know, until this is the stories you hear.
Can you describe your flight out?
Yeah.
On that night?
Yeah, we took off from Kievel as near as damn it, 25 past six. I think in this little article, I'll give you a copy of it, which deals with the lead up. And I suppose it must have been 9:30 when we landed. Now, the most marvellous thing about this was we'd had roughly 26 hours of briefing in two-hour sessions. And at the beginning of each briefing, we were shown a film. Now, the place was darkened down and the screen was put up. And you had this coming in over the sea, over the channel, and you saw the French coastline, and you came in closer and closer, and there were, I can't remember, four or five buildings which were like apartment blocks along the front of this particular run. And then, of course, you went over the top of those, and then you saw the town of Calm beyond. And at a point beyond that, on the approach to Calm, we were supposed to cast off, usually signal from the tug, and in fact we were doing a right hand, turn to starboard originally, and going in and landing towards the west. On the evening, there'd been a wind change, and it had veered round to the north. I don't know whether I use the right expression, the veered or the other way, but we were going to land south to north. Now this meant going nearer to Calm over the built up area more or less, and then come back at it and land facing north. Now we saw this film without that little bit on the end, of course, because that they couldn't plan for that. And as I say, we saw it at the beginning of each briefing session, we saw it at the end of each briefing session. So it was there. And everyone I speak to now, it was the most marvellous thing ever, because it was just as if I was seeing the film again. It was so accurate. And this had been taken by a mosquito.
Oh, on the actual area, not a model.
Oh, no. Taken by a mosquito flying fast. You see, and then they slowed the film down to our speed, and honestly it was just as if I'd been there before. It was so good. And of course I was on the on the outside of the turn, so I couldn't see the landing ground once we started to turn, because the first pilot sits on the left. And when we straightened up to come in, we'd been warned about holes in the ground which they directed, but unfortunately they'd sent paras in during the early morning, Royal Engineer paras, to dismantle as many poles, and the idea was to take them out in strips east to west. Of course this wind change meant that we were going to land south to north, so we were landing across them. And probably one of the most memorable sights was seeing a chap who obviously had probably lost air pressure, because he wasn't using flap and travelling much too fast. And he came up on our starboard side, it was going like the clappers, and he put it down on the deck, the idea to get it on the deck and then take as much speed off as you can by friction. And he went between two poles, put the fuselage between two poles, and it sheared off both wings almost simultaneously. And of course, having lost their weight and still having the lift, these wings cascaded up and down and round, and it, almost, absolutely symmetrical, I would say. And but anyway, we got down.
The flight out, did you see the fleet below?
Oh, yes. That too was so memorable, because the nearer you got, it seemed the more sea craft there were. You got the impression, well, if this rope broke now, I wouldn't hardly get wet, because I'd ditch alongside one of these guys and I would be quite safe in moments. It was almost as if you could walk across. It was as good other.
You could see their wakes and their...
Oh, yes. Mm. And it, no matter where you looked, you know, left to right, as far as the eye could see, you could see this, well, Armada, wasn't it, moving out. And the other thing, of course, was the Typhoon and Spitfires, which were guarding us. And they were flying underneath us and above us. And, of course, we didn't see one jet aircraft at all on the way over. Nothing. We did the following day when we were beginning to get to the beach, had to come back. There was a bit of strafing went on, but as soon as they showed, and it was uncanny to watch, you'd see these enemy aircraft coming in, and then they would just... the Bofors would open up and just cut them in two, as if, you know, as if they were on fixed lines, kind of thing. It was amazing, really was. So, yeah.
Anyhow, you got down in one piece.
We got down in one piece. We hit the hedge at the end of the field, and once again the canopy came in. My compass there came off the binnacle and struck me on the knee. And I thought, right, well, I'm not leaving you behind. And I brought it back. So I pinched that out of the glider and we got it back. I'd had it a number of years and it was covered in Air Force blue or grey. And I took it into a chemist one day and I said, look, I want to get this grey stuff off of you. Oh, he said, that's easy. And he gave me a bottle of acetone and I soaked it in that. And of course, it came up brass. Gwen has polished it ever since, occasionally. But that was one thing to remember, to bring back. And we unloaded, no trouble at all.
You unloaded what you backed it up then, did you?
No, when you in the last few yards, you've got your crew trained, your passengers trained. The blokes who were sat in the glider at the tail end, they've all got their specific jobs to do. One's got a pair of wire cutters. Two of them have then got spanners, quick release spanners. And the whole tail section can be dropped off by undoing 8 bolts around the perimeter of the fuselage. And of course, there's a gap cut out. He sticks his wire cutters in, he cuts it. Those are the controls to the tailplane.
Control cables, yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, that's it, you know.
So you just drive out the tail?
Yeah. Yeah. And, two of those ramps are taken out and connected up. And then you just start up, release the shackles, and it drives straight out. No problem at all. You ready for this, Gwen?
Anyhow, so you've got your load out.
We got the load out, yeah. And we sat on the tailboard having a cup of tea, as if it was an afternoon out.
Or didn't have any fighting?
Nice summer evening. No, none at all. We had to get one poor chap, Lieutenant Martin, who had two gliders had landed one on top of the other. And we got this Lieutenant Martin out, but he was beyond repair, I'm afraid. But we gave him morphine and all the rest of it. And he was on one of the other gliders. We were okay, so we got him onto a stretcher. And we took him with us until we met a medical group. And they took him over, but he died very soon after of multiple injuries, you know. And then, of course, we had to get back to a wooded area between the landing zone and the coast. And we dug in there for the night.
That's just you and your pilot?
The squadron.
Yeah.
Wherever you could pick them up, we rendezvoused, you see, and then came back as a... because we had another glider loaded here at Keeble, ready to go. And, of course, the idea was to get back as quickly as we can. Contrary to all our training, of course.
Yeah.
You know, what we had thought would happen.